Hi, this is Joe Francica, Editor-in-Chief of Directions Magazine. If you were watching CNN last month during the landing of the Mars exploration rovers, you might have seen anchorman Miles O'Brien speaking with NASA principal scientist Dr. Matt Gollenbeck. Dr. Gollenbeck led the site selection team of the Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. He was responsible for choosing the two landing sites of each rover and has also been selected as the science team chief for long-term planning during surface mission operations of the rovers. Dr. Gollenbeck was also the chief scientist for the Mars Pathfinder mission, which successfully landed the Sojourner rover on Mars on July 4, 1997. As project scientist, Dr. Gollenbeck chose the landing site for the spacecraft and was responsible for the overall scientific content of the mission. His research efforts almost entirely focus on Mars geology in general and the prediction of surface characteristics at a lander scale from orbital remotely sensed data. In his career, he's worked on a variety of topics related to the structural geology and tectonics of the Earth, terrestrial planets, and outer planet satellites. Dr. Gollenbeck has published over 80 papers in scientific journals and 230 abstracts. He's a graduate of Rutgers University, where he received his BA in geology, and he has a master's and PhD from the University of Massachusetts. Directions Magazine is pleased to present this exclusive interview with Dr. Gollenbeck in his efforts to map the Martian surface for the NASA mission to Mars. I hope you enjoy the interview. Like I said, our magazine is focused on geographic information systems.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to say we don't use any of them.
Is that right? Well, what is the techniques for mapping the surface? I mean, there's obviously an orbiter up there, capturing some map-based information.
Yeah, basically part of the site selection. Let me give you a few background on the site selection effort. It took about 3 years.
Yeah.
And unlike all previous selection efforts, we had two spacecraft in orbit around Mars that we could direct to take images of the prospective sites while they were in orbit. And that's really never been done before. During Viking, they actually did take pictures of their sites when they got into orbit.
Mm-hmm.
But they were on this incredibly short timeline to land their landers. So we not only acquired the information, but we had to process it and understand it and deal with it in terms of what the hazards of the surface would be like.
Right.
So basically there's sort of a variety of different data sets that we would use to make maps.
Mm-hmm.
And the background would be either the Viking data, which is typically at sort of several hundred meters per pixel. And then when Odyssey got into orbit, we were looking at about 100 meter per pixel thermal infrared images.
Mm-hmm.
And those sort of formed the background. And then from there, we looked at higher resolution, initially with the Mars orbiter camera on the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft, which took images down to anywhere between 6 meters per pixel to 1.5 meters per pixel.
Right.
And then we would attempt to place those on the 100 meter per pixel. And that actually, very often you got them wrong.
Right.
Because the difference in resolution was so huge.
Was there any sort of a projection system developed? I mean, do you have one for Mars?
Yeah, there's a latitude, longitude, and a cartographic grid, but
yeah.
You don't know precisely how that cartographic grid relates to inertial space,
okay,
which is what the orbiters are in. So there's always this uncertainty with respect to where a surface feature is, because you don't have a system of GPS receivers on the ground at known locations, and you don't have, a reference frame that's inertially built into, VLBI references and so on.
Yeah.
So actually there's several hundred meters uncertainty between our inertial frame and our cartographic frame. And that was pretty insignificant in terms of landing, because our landing ellipses are huge. They're 100 or even more kilometers long, but could be quite important once you landed and you tried to figure out where you were.
Yeah, sure.
And basically the best grid we have now is built from a topographic map that was made by the MOLA instrument, the Mars Orbiter Laser Altimeter, that provided a few hundred million elevation points in a polar, semi-polar orbit. But at the equator, those orbit tracks are typically separated by several kilometers. So, and matching up a feature, say a crater or some hill or something, with that topography was always uncertain to several hundred meters. You just can't do any better than that. So, yeah, you know where the camera was pointing when it took this 1 or 2 meter per pixel image, but you have actually no idea where on the surface precisely that image is located. And the only way to figure it out is to, in fact, do it by hand.
Really? So, yeah, so really when you determine the entry path of the, for the
spacecraft, we haven't even gotten there yet.
Yeah.
So we're still making maps, and what we found was that when Odyssey went into orbit and it started acquiring 20 meter per pixel visible images, then we could fairly reliably place those on the 100 meter per pixel images.
Okay.
Because your factor of 5 resolution isn't so great. And then we could fairly confidently place the 3 meter per pixel images on those 20 meter per pixel images, and we'd all adjust them to this net that we had the best we could from this MOLA instrument. And that's what we did, and it's all done by hand.
Is that right?
And it's all done, we're not computer geeks, we're geologists.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So, and we don't have staff like a GIS information guy.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the problem with GIS, is that it's just complicated enough that, you know, most idiots can't figure it out. And so we used something that was super simple and very easy to manipulate. We actually used commercial software called Canvas. In which you can put in layers of different information and hand manipulate them to get them all fit.
Wow.
And that's what we did.
Who makes Canvas?
Deniba.
Okay.
And it's just, it's kind of like a Photoshop or something. It's just a Mac-based or a PC-based program for projecting images, and you can stretch them and contrast enhance them and, you know, move them around and that kind of stuff.
So when they program the landing, what kind of area are you shooting at?
The ellipses typically are, for the first time, actually, this is the first time that the entire site selection effort was done digitally.
Right.
For Pathfinder, when we did it 7 years ago, we actually used paper.
Wow. Man.
Because, you know, you just didn't have. Now we can get the whole map of Mars in the, you know, in a PC and actually manipulate it.
Sure.
But the ellipses for the MERS were anywhere, when we started, 300 kilometers long by 50 kilometers wide, down to 100 kilometers long by 20 kilometers wide, and they're elongate along the flight path angle.
Okay.
And then when you get right down to the final ellipse, I think our final ellipses were like 80 kilometers long and, maybe 10 or 12 kilometers wide, 5 or 6, maybe less than 10, I would guess, yeah.
So when they're programming the orbiter, I mean, is it?
It's not an orbiter. It goes directly into the atmosphere.
Okay.
And they're doing that in inertial space, and you work as hard as you can to get the best cartographic tie in that local area as you can, so that the inertial space will map into the cartographic frame.
So you're just essentially shooting the whole thing right at Mars.
It's coming in. It's on a trans-Mars trajectory.
Okay.
And it is it's coming in, and you have a couple of trajectory correction maneuvers, and you have to hit the atmosphere at precisely the right flight path angle. If you're too shallow, you actually skip out.
Right.
If you're too steep, you'll burn up.
Right.
And the finer that you can control that flight path angle for a simple ballistic entry, which is what these MERS are, the more precisely you will land. And yet, even having done that, because of the uncertainty in the atmosphere and everything else, you're never going to get that much better than 100 kilometers. That's right. Really remarkable that we did as well as we did.
So you're pretty pleased with the way you hit it.
Oh, yeah, the navigation engineers, and that's not me, okay? I'm a geologist. I look at the surface. They did a spectacular job. Yeah.
What are you expecting to see from the data that you actually receive from Spirit of Opportunity? There is, I imagine, some sort of spectrometer on the craft that will actually do profile. I think I've even seen some of the
there's a bunch of different things. But let me back up one step. Basically, we spent 3 years looking at all of this information, and we actually made a series of predictions of the landing site based on the remote sensing data. So in a sense, you can think about these landers as ground truth points for a remote sensing exercise. And basically, I can go through in gritty detail, but you probably don't want to hear them. But the first order, we predicted that the landing sites would be safe for the lander. They would be, the surfaces would be trafficable for the rover. And for Gusev, we predicted about a third of the rocks, area covered by rocks on the surface, as the other three landing sites. And at Meridiani, we suggested it would have very few, if any, rocks, and it would be a very dark gray basalt and granule covered surface. And,
right.
And the first order, our predictions were remarkably good.
Really? Wow.
So I'm the only person to have ever correctly predicted a landing site on Mars, and I've now done it 3 times.
So, I mean, you had a multispectral.
So on the rover, then there are two remote sensing instruments.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is actually more than that, but there's two science remote sensing instruments. One's called PanCam, which is a panoramic camera. It can look completely around in stereo all through the visible with about 12 or 13 filters.
Mm-hmm.
So it can see in color, and it can see in stereo, and its visual accuracy is probably sufficient to do an IMAX film if you wanted to, about a third of a micron per pixel. And then we have a mini test, a mini thermal emission spectrometer, which gets at the thermal emittance of the surface, which is quite diagnostic for a variety of minerals, which is really what geologists want to know about the surface, of course. And it also tells you things like thermal inertia and temperature and albedo.
Hmm.
And then you use those two remote sensing instruments, along with a variety of engineering cameras, which I haven't mentioned, to decide which rock or which feature to go and investigate in detail.
Right.
And you go over to that, and you image them, and you get the mini spectra. And then you have an arm that has four instruments on it. It has a microscopic imager that can see down to about 38 microns per pixel. About, a 10x hand lens kind of thing. And it has a alpha particle X-ray spectrometer, which gets at basically the X-ray. It tells you the chemical composition of what the material is made of.
Right.
And it has a Mossbauer spectrometer, which tells you about iron mineralogy, dominantly, any olivines, any magnetites, anything that has iron in it, pretty much, you can kind of coax out. And then it has a thing called a RAT, which is a rock abrasion tool. And so it can actually grind away the weathering rind of a rock and look at the fresh underlying. So that's the equivalent of a rock hammer.
Right. I saw today where they were drilling in about, 2.7 millimeters?
Yeah, a few millimeters, just trying to get below the weathering rind, get through all the dust, all that stuff. And so basically from these instruments, you really, it's basically a robotic field geologist.
Right.
And it is roving around at our instructions and doing field geology and trying to figure out what those surfaces are and what the materials are and how they got there.
Yeah. I mean, what's been your most gratifying discovery so far? I mean, you're obviously looking for sources of or indications of water. I mean,
For me personally, it was clearly the fact that after spending 3 years studying these places that are predictions from the remote sensing data on the overall surface characteristics and safety characteristics were validated by. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sites are pretty much what we said they were going to be.
Right.
Scientifically, we went to these two locations because they had clear either morphologic evidence of water in the case of Gusev Crater or mineralogic evidence for water in the case of the Meridiani site. And it's too soon in the mission. We have not seen anything at any of the sites that would confirm or deny those speculations at this point. But, you know, we've only really just begun to begin our traverses and to, you know, start our business. So,
Is there going to be an attempt to actually spectrally map the surface based on the information you find? I mean, can you actually determine, or link the location of the rover with the actual mineralogical composition of certain samples so that maybe you can come up with kind of a mini map of the geology?
Yeah, that's in fact the idea, is that as you traverse, you gain information on either sides of the rover so that you create this little patchwork geologic map of the ground sample that can be displayed in three dimension and actually relate back to the orbiter information. So, yeah, that's a prime goal. The prime goal is to really look and try to see if we can find out, first of all, identify the rock types and from that the environment of those rock types and the outcrop at the Opportunity landing site is obviously a key that we're going to spend a fair bit of time at. And our approach at Gusev is to traverse to that crater to look for different kinds of rocks that may have been brought up by the cratering event.
Are you able to tell, again, just over the several years that you've looked at the Martian surface, either the sedimentation patterns or the volcanic patterns that would give you an indication that there is any kind of likeness to the way the Earth was formed or what we see geomorphologically today, layer cake geology, obviously there's tons of volcanology. I mean,
well, there's clearly basaltic shield volcanoes on Mars,
right?
And we know that Mars is at least partially made of basalt. We've got that confirmed now from a large variety of sources. But there's intriguing evidence in the ancient crater terrain for very high erosion rates and the almost undeniable action of liquid water at a variety of scales that have produced erosion and deposition in the Noachian era of Mars, which would be sort of pre 3.5 billion years. And then there's a real change in the erosional style and the surface that suggests that Mars has been dry and desiccating since the Hesperian, which is the middle era of geologic history on Mars, and through the Amazonian, which is the youngest era of geologic history. And so these locations that we took these rovers to are places where there's evidence of water, either in mostly in the late Noachian time. And the idea is to see what the environment was on Mars at a time when we know that life got started here on Earth. So we have clear chemical evidence for life on Earth at about 3.9 billion years, something like that, almost as soon as the Earth cools from its extremely hot, steam-sterilizing early environment. And in fact, Mars could have had a more conducive environment earlier on than the Earth did because of that.
So that's the
holy grail, is to find out, whether the environment was suitable for the formation of life. And if it was, and life did not form there, then why not? What makes us so special? And if it did form there, then what happened to it?
Yeah, right. So you're thinking, the current thinking is that life may have ceased on Mars at the time that it was beginning on Earth?
Well, we don't know if life even started there. We don't know if we had a second genesis. We do know that pieces of Mars and Earth have been commingling throughout geologic time. We have a series of, 30 rocks that we're convinced come from Mars. And it's not impossible to imagine that pieces of Earth got to Mars and by similar, cratering events that could have thrown bits of pieces of things off that weren't completely melted or fried. So those are all distinct possibilities. The question is, you know, did life start there and come here? Are we all Martians?
Yeah.
Or did it start only once? And if so, what's so special about us?
Are you saying that there was essentially some sort of accretive event that occurred on either planet? In other words, something from...
We know that the planets all formed at the time that the solar system formed.
That's, sure.
Yeah, 4.6 billion years. And during the tail end of accretion of the planets, there were large planetesimals that were, you know, sort of impactors the size of, you know, tens or even hundreds or even bigger kilometers that sort of coagulated in a rather violent way.
Yeah.
And on the Earth, because of its closeness to the sun and the likely wet conditions, those early events would have flashed the water to steam and actually sterilized the planet for the first, 500 million years or so.
Hmm.
So it's not surprising that the first life we see on the Earth formed after those sterilizing impacts stop.
Sure.
Now, Mars is farther from the sun, so the velocity of the impactors would be lower, and it's likely that you would not have steam sterilized it. So there's a chance, although this is all conjecture, everything I've mentioned is just the result of models,
that
life could have actually started earlier on the Mars and even come to Earth. Or it started on Mars and it started on Earth, and it would start anywhere that liquid water is stable.